Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly free show here on Renegade Radio and iHeartRadio and YouTube, Spotify, Audible, Stitcher, everywhere you listen to podcasts. It's a Dark Mark show. I'm Dark Mark, the goth comedian. And of course, as always, my co-host, everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole Six.
Hello.
Is that a new thing, the kiss? That's a new, like...
I've been doing either a kiss or a peace sign.
Okay, well, they're both appropriate today because we've got quite a guest, and you know how excited I've been for this week. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
And we have, I was waiting for Nicole to say, oh, yeah. You've been talking about it all week. As a matter of fact, we posted a video last night, and we were talking about how excited we are.
You sent me a lot of information on this one, and that's actually rare. Mark doesn't usually send me that much information. I know he does extensive research on all the people he has on the show, but he definitely likes it. He likes Lily a lot.
Right. I've been a fan for a long time. I saw her live. We were trying to figure out when and where, but I remember seeing her live and then just the next day going to the record store trying to find her CDs, which I might still have somewhere, although I throw out most of my CDs. But I don't need to introduce her. It would take the whole show, but from being a child actress and being the daughter of Columbo to having her own solo career to, playing with rock and roll legends. She's played with Clanton Page. She's played with Sting. She's played with Parliament Funkadelic. She's played with Herbie Hancock. I think everybody that gets in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has to play with her at some point. And also she's played on probably your favorite album, from Hootie the Blowfish to Christina Aguilera. She's toured with Cyndi Lauper. She's toured with everybody. And she has a new album coming out. First one in 7 years. Oh, she's a Grammy Award winner, too, with her group Opium Moon that she has with her husband. And is coming out with her new album, first one in 7 years. First solo album, first non-soundtrack solo album in 7 years. It's called More Love. I've heard it. It's terrific. Lily Hayden.
Hello.
Woo!
Thank you for having me.
And as you know, I just scratched the surface. You are the most interesting person in the world, I think.
Well, thank you for saying so. I have a story for everything, pretty much. I think I remember meeting I think it was Joni Mitchell. Actually, I met somebody who had just interviewed Joni Mitchell, and basically he said that no matter what he said, she had a story about it. It was like, you know, I had breakfast. You know, when I had breakfast with Truman Capote, or, you know, it was like whatever the, so I figure as the older I get, the more stories I will have. You won't be able to say anything without telling a story, just like I just did, actually.
Yes, the modern day Joni Mitchell, Lily Hayden.
Well, I was not comparing myself to her at all. Just
as a raconteur.
The older you get, the more stories you accumulate. So yes.
And has a great interior decoration sense as well. Looking at your house.
Well, thank you. This is my studio.
Or your studio.
Yes, a little look into the studio.
But before we get started,
right there needs something. I need to put like a something there. I'm seeing.
No, you're okay. You're fine. It's all right. Well,
do you have any cats?
Any hats or cats?
Cats.
Wait, I'm still not getting. Is that a cat? Like a meow?
Yes, like a cat.
Yeah, I do. Would you like me to put my cat there?
No, I was looking at your place and it's so beautiful. I was thinking she must have cats. She has the benevolent cat lady look going on.
Right. Well, actually, I do have a cat. My soulmate cat baby just died and I'm broken up about it. But I am looking, but I think I found a new little kitten and she laid a baby. Yeah, she's 2 weeks old and we're going to bring her home in about a month. So.
Fantastic. Great. Your house needs cats. I can tell that. Like, I could just sense that about your aesthetic.
Well, thank you. That's a high compliment. I believe it was Oscar Wilde who said that if man were and cats were merged, it would greatly elevate the man and greatly degrade the cat.
So before we get started, and we're already starting, Nicole showing how perceptive she is. Real quick, we are sponsored by Audible. And please, you're on the road all the time. I'm sure you listen to audiobooks all the time. You can get anything. They have everything from Shakespeare to smut. If you go to audibletrial.com/DMS, you can get a book on violin. You can get a book on rock and roll. You can get a book on, or you have a recommendation, Nicole.
I was going to say, I've been reading this by Brandon Sanderson. It's called Mistborn. And I think it'd be really good. I've been actually thinking about getting on Audible so I can go out when I've been exercising a lot lately because it's summertime almost. Mm-hmm. And I would love to get this on Audible and just listen to it while I'm walking. I think that'd be great.
Well, I will double check if it's on Audible. Everything's on there. So I would imagine it would be. Go to audibletrial.com/DMS. Get something for free. You get a free book and access to hundreds of Audible originals. Just go to audibletrial.com/DMS. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast. We're on Audible, too. Last night, Lily, you're vegan, right?
How could this happen? I turned off my phone. Sorry. I used to be vegan, but I had surgery on my knee, and I started craving blood. So my doctor said I had to, like, if I wanted to recover better, that I needed a little animal protein. So...
That's okay. I'm sure you've been to do me some cooking.
You know, I never cooked before. I make great snacks. But since the last couple of months, I've actually been getting, for some reason, there's like the muse of cooking has been whispering in my ear. And I've been doing little experiments with fire.
That's great. Our favorite restaurant, vegan restaurant that sponsors the show, is Do Me's Home Cooking on Fountain and Vine. Right next to where the M Bar used to be. We went there last night. Nicole had the nachos. I had the shrimp po' boy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead, Nicole.
I was just going to say there are tons of jalapenos on the nachos, and the cheese is amazing. It's just like getting nacho cheese.
Wow.
LA Weekly voted Doomy's Home Cooking's nachos one of the 10 best in LA, the only one without meat. I had a shrimp po' boy sandwich. 1253 Vine Street, if you're in Los Angeles. They have outdoor dining. They have a little tent. You can dine there. They're open 24 hours on the weekends. There's one in Toronto, Canada, and one in Culver City. And also, we're sponsored by Raise Energy Drink, and I'm going to drink that. If you go to the description of this podcast, you can get 15% off a case.
You should also get
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you should consider getting a sponsorship by MAC Makeup for their eyeliner.
Oh.
I tried. I might just. I will.
In fact, since...
what would I do without you, Lily Hayden?
I'm going to put a little eye makeup on right now just to join in the fun. I thought it would be a nice way to, you know, bond.
Goth it up.
We'll see.
That's probably a good place to start because I don't know where to start with you because there's so much... you must have, especially in the late 90s, early 2000s, had a big goth following.
You know, I guess I did. I was raised by a single mother who was a comedian, Lotus Weinstein. Right. She was the first woman to perform at the Comedy Store, and she was engaged to Lenny Bruce the last year of his life. And my dad was a conspiracy theorist and the first person to mass produce LSD alongside Owsley Stanley. And he created the show New Wave Theater. And I was just me. I had no friends except for my cat. So Nicole, very perceptive. so I guess that automatically makes you goth.
If your cat is your only friend, you might be goth. That is a thing.
Well, I did see a clip of you wearing very chunky Frankenstein-y, probably lip service boots while you were playing violin.
I do that partly because I'm only 5 feet tall, and also because I have knee issues, so I can't wear like the steep heels. I can only wear things that make you feel like so the bigger the you know the more like tires they are, the better for me, because then I'm less likely to fall over. So, and when I'm playing my wah-wah pedal with the violin, you can't really wear heels like that. You gotta, you know, have some heft.
So that's about the time, as I was telling you before the show, that's about the time I discovered you, was around 2002, 2003 when I first moved to LA, saw you live. Your parents are very unusual. Now, you grew up with probably the most rock and roll parents there ever were. Because Lotus Weinstock is responsible for the belly room at the Comedy Store.
That's right.
Every male and female comic that goes to LA that does a show at the belly room, including myself, has her to thank.
That's right. That's right. She was just really profound. She was kind of a comedy avatar in a way. She was like aphorisms, unrequited love is just God's way of saying, imagine how I feel.
She was kind of an alternative comic before her time.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was, and it was always, she had the sharpest tongue, but the deepest compassion. So she wasn't cruel for the sake of it. She would just make fun of our idiosyncrasies. I think in the spirit of humanizing everyone. So she'd say things like, well, the Bible says, love your neighbors, you love yourself. But if you don't like yourself, your neighbor's in trouble.
She was versatile enough. She performed in the Smothers Brothers, but she was also on the tape Dirty Jokes with Jackie the Joke Man and Dice Clay and Ronaldo Ray, Red Fox. Yep. So she, Nicole, I was watching a thing today on YouTube. There was news report from the Comedy Store in La Jolla from like 1979.
Okay.
And the reason this made news is there were four females on the bill. There were no guys. That was the first time that ever happened. And your mother hosted that.
That's great.
And interestingly, I think that may have been the show. She had a heckler who, and this is a story that just really sums up my mom. There was a heckler in the audience who was really giving her a hard time, and she you know, jousted with her, you know, she said something to make fun of the heckler that, you know, just as comics do. And then after the show, the heckler came up to my mom and slapped her on the face in the parking lot. And my mom, in her wisdom and compassion, hugged her. Actually gave her a hug and said, I'm sorry that you're suffering. And the woman started to cry, and my mom proceeded to give her therapy for a couple of hours. I don't know if they became friends so much, because obviously the woman was troubled, but that was an emblematic story.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm about to cry myself. And I don't want to dig into your dad too much because, from what I understand, not the greatest father. However, an apocryphal figure in counterculture, just for New Wave Theater alone, which was a punk rock precursor to MTV.
Yeah.
But the Rolling Stones have a famous drug bust, and he was known as the Acid King, and he was the one supplying the drugs.
Yeah, my dad was the first person to turn them on to LSD, and also the Beatles, supposedly. And then he assumed all sorts of aliases it wasn't illegal at the time, so they put him away. They trumped up some other charges, and he had to get out of Canada on a dead guy's passport, came to America, and then was paranoid for the rest of his life, and had several different names. And so that's why I was called Cherub Aquarian for till I was 12.
I heard that you were, when you were able to speak, they said that you could choose your name, and you chose Lollipop.
No, actually, Helicopter.
I can't read my own writing. I'm sorry. I did not write down, and I got wrong.
That's all right. Helicopter. Lollipop would be an interesting porn name, but Helicopter, because I think, and I understand, because, you know, it was chaotic when I was a kid with, you know, all the comedians and the outlaws. and we lived on a commune, and the Brotherhood of the Source, and my dad, who was known as the Acid King, as you said, came and had a duel with the guru of the commune, Father Yod. So the Acid King and Father Yod went head to head in order to take us out of what my dad thought was a cult. Anyway, all that to say, I wanted to be called Helicopter to get the fuck out of there.
I'm familiar with Father Yod. Like, I've heard stories about that.
Yeah, well,
that's something
to do with. So Father Yod started the Source family, which was the commune that had the Source restaurant on Sunset Boulevard until I don't know when it was torn down, but it was an offshoot of the American Sikhs. You know, you've seen Americans with the turbans, the white turbans, and my mom joined. And she did a whole joke about it. It was the cheapest form of therapy around. All you had to do is give them your car and change your name. And and so I was called Cherub until I was 12. And there's this wonderful documentary called The Source Family that talks about it.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely a name that's come up before. I've definitely heard it in my circles.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is that you had probably the most rock and roll parents there were. I mean, your mother was really, if Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was set in the 70s and 80s, that's her.
Yeah, exactly.
And your father is, you know, your father's the Acid King and dealing to Rose. And by the way, you played with the Rolling Stones, didn't you?
I was in the studio with them, but I was cut off the album. But Don was hired me to play on their album. But the funny thing is that, my mom was writing songs when I was growing up, and I wasn't really, you know, so she wasn't listening to a lot of stuff. She was friends with Richie Havens and Tim Hardin. But I didn't listen to pop music or rock, pop or rock growing up. So it was just classical music and my mom's music. So when I got to in the studio with the Rolling Stones, I had never heard them. I heard them live in the studio and I said, they're a really good band. And they were. So
the drug bust never came up, I would assume.
You know, I think I don't know that I would have been allowed to stay in the studio had they known who my dad was. I actually I had to contend a little bit with that. My dad was he was brilliant and soulful, but mentally ill and a drug addict. So you know, this was not an easy incarnation for him. If you want to,
I'm sure.
That way.
I always thought your last name, your stage name Hayden. I always thought that was from the classical composer, but apparently that was one of your mom's stage names. Is that correct?
It was. She took that name in the 60s. She didn't want to go with Weinstock, which was her maiden, and. So she went by Maury Hayden. And then when she got with my dad was just too much of an outlaw. And so she just called me. Actually my legal name is Lilith, in the spirit of the female, the succubus who preceded Eve, who was known as a baby killer because she was independent.
Lilith was kicked out of Eden because she wanted to be on top.
Exactly
how that sounds.
Exactly.
Well, heaven's loss is Hollywood's game. Anyway, speaking of Hollywood, now you're living in a commune, but then you became a big child actress. You were in shows I've never heard of, and I can't believe I couldn't even believe they'd existed. There's a show called Mrs. Columbo.
Yeah.
About Columbo's wife. Kate Mulgrew plays Columbo's wife, and the new Gidget.
Yeah. Yeah, I paid for college. I paid for college with the money I made acting, and paid for my violin. And I got a sense of, thank goodness I was able to, because we were on welfare, and I wouldn't have been able to, you know, do what I do without that. But also now, as a film composer, I love my background acting because I relate to the scenes, and I relate to drama in a kind of a personal way that I don't think you get if you're just going to film school. I mean, you know, film composing school.
You've been on set, so you know what everybody's job is, especially the actors, and you know how to what they're doing and how to enhance that.
Yeah, and it's also relating to people dramatically, you know, engaging. So it's a very similar skill to supporting a lead singer, so to speak.
Right.
So also being in a scene.
Well, and we're going to get to your music in a second. I've got a ton of notes. There's so much to you. But I have one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. I watched it last night. I was still laughing. It was Easy Money, the Rodney Dangerfield, Joe Pesci starring movie that you played Rodney Dangerfield's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you have a story about everybody. Yeah. Do you have a Rodney Dangerfield story?
I was exaggerating. He was very nice to me. He was very nice to me, and I'm a good mimic, and that was how I got the gig, was basically like mocking him to his face, and he was a good sport about that. So
yeah, you even did the neck.
Exactly. I don't care.
but one thing, I found out that you collaborated with Taylor Negron, who I met once. We did a show together, and couldn't have been a nicer guy, just an amazing guy.
Yeah.
And just, we talked for like an hour, and he told me, can you confirm this? He told me that the big wedding scene, Joe Pesci wouldn't come out of his trailer unless they let him sing a song, and the director is just like, okay, let him sing the song, and he cut it out. Is that
true? I
don't
remember that. I was so freaked about developing breasts. That I was like, I was trying not to grow up. I was so freaked that I was like, also there was a big, I can't remember what they were called. It was like a big ring of child molesters and I was like, sure, I was going to get molested or something. So I was just so freaked about, I was not my finest, you know, comedy was my savior and violin was my savior. But essentially, I think Joe Pesci put some rice down my dress and I kicked him in the shins. He probably still has a scar on his, I was 10 years old and I kicked Joe Pesci in the skin and in the shins and drew blood. So this is all adding up to a very goth portrait, isn't it?
We're getting there. But did they write the violin scene for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a scene, Nicole, where, she's practicing violin, and Rodney Dangerfield's trying to work on a model airplane. He keeps like, he's all shaky. It's a whole thing. But and then Joe Pesci comes up and is like, "What's that, Mozart?" And I could kind of tell you that might not have gone along.
And I looked at him after in answer to "What's that, Mozart?" I was looking scales.
And he said, "Never heard of him." Anyway, wow. So then but you paid for your first violin at age 7 from all this money. Now, what drew you to violin? What did you hear that drew you there?
I had a dream that I could play violin, and my mom honored it. And they wouldn't let me into the orchestra because I was too little. They didn't have a violin small enough for me. And so my mom, she drove me to the music store. We rented a violin. And that day she wrote a song in G major, which is a key where you could just play open strings on the violin without knowing how to actually play. So it gave me a sense of jamming right away. And normally on violin, you're not making music till, you know, for 5 years because it's such a horrible sound. But with the open strings, I could jam with her right away. And the song was Mama's Pride. And so it was probably the greatest gift she could have given me.
I love that.
That's amazing. And you paid for an Ivy League education out of your acting as well.
Yeah.
You went to Brown and you were going to, be an activist.
I am an activist, but I was going to be a human rights lawyer. I was going to be a human rights lawyer. And I worked for the East Harlem Interfaith Coalition for Fair Banking for one semester in effort to, you know, help them combat redlining, which is when banks draw a red line around a community and say, don't lend to them because their, you know, their skin is different color than other people. And so that's illegal, but there were no teeth in the regulations. So anyway, I was working with, but I got a sense of how, of really the martyrdom of the public policy workers, because the change is so incremental that it's just, I don't know how anybody has, you know, doesn't just go get eaten alive. So I basically juxtaposed that that passion for fairness and justice with the reaction and the kind of the effect that I seemed to have on a person-to-person level when I was playing for people. People would come up to me and say that they were moved and that it made them feel things that they hadn't felt before. And to me, that was sort of a microcosmic, you know, that appealed to my soul. Just said, yes, that's what you should be doing instead of public policy.
You should always be doing things that feed your soul.
Yeah, but also it was a way to, I feel like for me, the way that I justify making music, especially in the face of vast suffering, is that when you play music and you're doing something that's really coming from your heart, it makes the people in front of you feel something in their heart. And when you feel your own heart, you're more likely to be sensitive to the heart of the person in front of you, of, you know, the hearts around you. And I think it makes people more compassionate or at least more present and aware. And that is, to me, the seed of peace that I hope will blossom throughout the world. If we all do that in some way, right. I think, you know, nothing, only good can come from that.
Right. The irony being you're reaching more people with music than you ever would, you know, as a lawyer.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
Quite possibly. Yeah.
So, and so you, now what brought you back to music?
My violin was stolen, actually. I didn't stop playing violin, but my violin was stolen. It just wasn't my first priority. I thought, well, how am I ever going to make a living making music? And my parents were starving artists, and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be a starving artist. But money was really never the guiding force for me. It was always passion and justice. But my violin was stolen, and I basically, the universe forced me to make a decision. You know, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to let it go away, or are you going to come back and fight for it? And I borrowed a violin, and my mom picked me up from the airport when I came home from college, and we went right to Genghis Cohen, which was a club in Hollywood. It still is, I guess. And I sat in with one of her friends, and I have good ears, so I was able to just jump in, and the thrill of jamming with people, and then the other singer-songwriters that came up to me afterwards who asked me to play with them and collaborate with them, it was like starting, it ignited a fire in me that I couldn't, that I'd never felt before. And it was so clear that this was, I spent the entire summer jamming with people, went back for my senior year, and it was, I was not as great a student as I could have been on my fourth year. I mean, I graduated with, you know, well, and a poli-sci degree and stuff, but music became my passion, and I just knew it. And the second I graduated, I was in 10 bands and playing 10 gigs a day. And my band at the time got taken to the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland after only 6 months of being together. And it was just kind of one thing after another. And then that band broke up and I started my solo thing. And I just, the sheer magic of collaborating with people was just something. It was a total drug, just like nothing I'd ever felt.
That's right, beautiful.
And this is, it is beautiful. And this is after you had played with the Los Angeles Philharmonic when you were 15.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that the classical world is a, you know, there's, I'm sure there's a thrill there, but it's such a perfectionist, you know, environment that it's, the sheer terror outweighs the joy, at least for me, terror of making a mistake, and that's no way to live. So that's, so I realized that I could only really be happy trying to be the best Lily that I could be. When I try to be anybody else or fit into anybody else's category, it can be hard. Film composing has been interesting because, you know, there are rules. There is protocol. There are politics, especially now I'm doing more work for commercial projects. In fact, I just found out that the TV series that I just scored, Ginny and Georgia, has broken all of the records for, it's been number one for longer than any other show on Netflix since they've been rating things.
That's great.
Which is fun. So anyway, the point is that I do have to play a little bit by the rules in that, but I am, you know, it's a kind of a balancing act of like, you know, if I just played by the rules and I'd be one of, you know, tens of thousands of film and TV composers that, do that. But if I just was this kind of unhinged artist, I would never be able to play nice with big productions and budgets and stuff. So it's just the right balance of getting to just go into my cave and be crazy and unhinged, and also learning to fit in.
Right. And by the way, I don't have Netflix. I'm thinking of getting it for a month just to check it out. But from the description I've seen, Ginny and Georgia is about a 15-year-old who's more mature than her 30-year-old mother.
Yeah.
Something possibly you could relate to?
My mom and I were defied category. I mean, yes. And also my mom was absolutely spirit, was an angel in a human body, and she defied all categories,
right.
Which made it hard for her in some ways, because I think it made it hard, you know, people didn't know how to sell her. So I was always, you know, I'm Capricorn, for whatever that's worth, kind of grounded and more like, you know, and so my form of, I had to balance her out a little bit. So I was kind of her, she would call me her emotional pit bull, and I looked out for her. I do relate to that. It's been compared to the Gilmore Girls. And I also think it has elements of Dexter as well.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's
Gilmore
kind of
Girls meets Dexter. I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. Gilmore Girls meets Dexter. So it's pretty fun. And, it's good.
But you, you got your violin back. How long before you start becoming, you had a residency at the Viper Room, when the Viper Room was the hippest spot in town? It was the Viper Room.
Yeah.
That was mid-90s.
Yeah, mid-90s.
How did that come about?
I was playing with so many bands, and I was just basically a regular at, you know, I was a regular at all the main major clubs in LA as a sideman, and I would do my solos, and I started writing my own music because I started noticing that all my solos were the same. I was doing this, like, I kept hearing melodies that I try to shove into other people's music, like the same. And it was, and my boyfriend at the time said, you're playing the same solo in everybody's song. I think it's time to start writing your own songs. So I started doing that, and I went up to the, I think my first solo gig was at Genghis Cohen. And I said, look, I want to do my own set here. And I didn't have any music yet, but I just said, but I set it up and I threw it together, and people seemed to dig it. And it was just so much fun to be, you know, I was encouraged to be crazy and to not fit into, like, to just take all my wacky ideas. And I wasn't bound by genre because I didn't grow up listening to any one thing. For me, you know, having three cellos and a hardcore, you know, funk punk bass, you know, juxtaposed with, you know, some industrial sounds, to me, that was like, yeah, this is a metaphor for life. You know, it's sweet and horrible. And it's, you know, and I was self-righteous about it, and I didn't know there were any boundaries. So I just did whatever the fuck I wanted. I started having to fit into things when I got signed to Atlantic. And I think it was a very tough adjustment period trying to figure out how to mm-hmm. pack my poetic sensibilities in the space of, you know, these little in a pop song package, and not lose my magic and not lose, you know, what made me sort of not lose my exuberance. And I had a song, you know, when people would try to make me fit in, I wrote a song called "There's Only So Much a Little Girl Can Take Before She Loses Her Mind," and then I'd scream with my teeth in the microphone, and then I'd step on the distortion and I go, you know,
that's incredible.
And people would come just to see the girl with the violin scream, you know, freak out, because I'd have a, you know, like, it's been a process. I feel like film composing is actually, in a way, one of the places where that kind of poetic, you know, stream of consciousness, nonlinear sensibility is rewarded for the right projects. You know, obviously there's things you have to do and you've got to support, you know, you're supporting somebody else's vision. But there's no, like, there are no, you don't absolutely have to do anything. It's whatever works. You know, the only thing you got to do.
Because in your film scoring, you've not only do you have the violin, which works obviously, but you know, you've done like filthy rap songs and hard rock songs and just whatever works for the scene.
Yeah, it's really, really fun for me. And I also have gained a much greater respect for space. How sometimes the thing that's called for is just one single note, and you don't, like, anything else will distract you from what needs to happen. So that sense of that appreciation of spaciousness is what I'm calling into my new music, which is one of the things I'm proudest of on this new album that comes out tomorrow. I love it because it feels like the film of my life, or the film that I'd like to be scoring. It feels like, you know, it's spacious, and then in the center of all that space is are a couple of intense poems, kind of, you know, intense emotional offerings.
That's really cool. I think that's gonna be really great.
Thanks.
And by the way, I don't know if that was an intentional pause or Zoom freezing up, but that was the perfect pause, the perfect piece of space right in the middle of you telling that. But I was going to ask you, just as a side, what you thought or what you think of other bands that have mixed classical and rock, like Rasputina or Emily Autumn, or they came out a little after you, but did you look at them and they're like, oh, they're ripping me off, or did you like it?
Oh, I love it. You know, look, I think, especially now, having, you know, climbed the, you know, I feel like this is going to sound, I don't know how this will sound. I feel like, you know, when you hear of people making pogroms, having to climb through mountains of Afghanistan to, like, you know, get to freedom, you know, that the people who have navigated the world of surviving as an artist, there is an element of that kind of you know, what's the word? I don't know what the word, but that kind of nomadic, you know, challenge, especially now, I have so much respect for anybody who makes anything and feels it authentically. You know, it's the only time that I ever get, you know, put off from something is when it feels calculated in a way that where the commercial considerations seem to be more important than the artistic voice. You know, there's, I think for me, it always starts from a spark of inspiration. And then there's the discipline of actually seeing something through to the end. You know, not, it doesn't always come out in one fell swoop, but I just have a lot of respect for anybody who does anything authentically. So classical meets whatever. I love hybrid stuff. I love when people are imaginative. Imagination is what makes human beings lovable to me.
Right. And, you know, so an example of an artist that did that, that actually, I guess they saw you at the Viper Room and picked you up on tour, was Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, which that's an amazing story in itself, that you got to play with them, yeah, playing Kashmir and at the Forum.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you didn't know the song.
I didn't. Well, don't tell them that.
Well, you know, because you did a great cover of it.
Right. Well, I did do the cover of it only about 15 years after I played with them, though. But I had people told me about Led Zeppelin, but I'm a little dyslexic. So when somebody offered to take me to see Van Halen, I somehow in my mind, I thought it was Led Zeppelin. And I went to them to the concert and I cried because I was so unhappy. And that, so when I finally got invited to a Led Zeppelin concert, it was Page and Plant and my friends, the Tragically Hip, were opening for them. And I jumped on a train down to San Diego because they weren't doing the LA show because they had somebody else opening for them in LA. And I was, and I knew somebody, the leader of the Egyptian orchestra, that was on tour with Page Plant. So I was invited past the velvet rope of the, you know, the buffer around Jimmy and Robert. And when I met them, I gave them a flyer to my show at the Viper Room the next night. And happily, they came with their entire entourage, and they were really supportive. And then I asked them if I could sit in and at their show at the Forum. And I didn't know that they didn't invite people, that people don't sit in with Led Zeppelin. I just asked, I was in the habit of asking everybody if I could sit in. So I just thought, well, that would be fun. And they said, yes. And they said, well, you know, Kashmir, right? I said, oh, sure. Yeah, of course. And I didn't. But I have good ears. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I was playing with Herbie Hancock, I was on tour with him for a summer. And I really didn't studied jazz formally, so I didn't know the tunes. You know, he knew that I wasn't actually a jazz player. He said, "I'm bringing you out to do what you do because I was a fan of my records." He said. So one night he changed up the set list and was like, he just called out a bunch of his famous tunes. One of them is Maiden Voyage, which is literally like jazz 101. Like every kid in jazz band plays fucking Maiden Voyage. And I didn't, you know, I said to Herbie, so, you know, this kind of reminds me of when I learned to play Kashmir on stage with Led Zeppelin. And, cause I was learning to play his standard on stage with him. And he said, oh yeah, but that's easy. That's just rock and roll. So.
Now, how did Herbie Hancock, I mean, other than the fact you've played on every record for the last 20 years, how did Herbie Hancock find out who you were?
I was, do you know who Don Was is? Don Was?
Yes, Don Was, the great producer. He was had a band, Was Not Was.
Yeah, so he's produced the Rolling Stones, and he's head of Blue Note Records now, and he was friends with Paul Reiser, the comedian, who was friends with my mom. And Paul brought Don Was down to the Viper Room, and Don invited me to play on a bunch of records that he was producing, including the Rolling Stones record at the time.
Right.
And was not what orchestra was basically a record that he made for himself, where he called in like an all-star band. And I was invited to, I spent a week at what was then Ocean Way Studios with Terrence Blanchard, Sheila E., Herbie Hancock, who else? Like a handful of some of the biggest artists biggest ever. And I was just, I got to hang out with him. And so Herbie invited me to play on his record at the time. And about 10 years later, invited me to be in his band.
Nice.
See, you're the coolest person that goes in every room and everybody wants to hang out with you. That's what it is.
Well, that's
you're very kind of charming, clearly.
I mean, George Clinton said you're the Hendrix of violin. Now, there's got to be a story how you met George Clinton.
Yes.
It's of the Parliament of Funkadelic, if people don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So so when I graduated college, I joined a band called Weapon of Choice. My big solo was on a song called I Can't Stand Fucking Cops. I can't stand fucking cops. I can't stand fucking cops. Anyway, so I did my little thing. And he took me to P-Funk, Parliament Funkadelic, down at the Anaheim Convention Center. And we sat, you know, 5 feet from the stage. And I heard Michael Hampton do Maggot Brain. If you don't know that song, it's a seminal guitar god song. And he played it and everything in me just said, that's what I want to do. And it was like a tsunami of knowingness. Anytime I heard that P-Funk was in town, I would go up to this, I'd bring my violin, I'd go up to the stage and I basically would do everywhere I went. I always had my violin because I always wanted to play. I would go up to a stage and like point to the violin and say, let me play now. And sometimes people would let the little girl up just as a laugh. And I have perfect pitch and I jump up and I usually do, you know, I'd usually land on my feet. So I tried this with them, but they had such a big entourage that probably 10 times. I probably tried to get up on stage with them 10 times. It never worked. It was just such chaos and they didn't need me.
What's the problem with Funkadelic? If there's like 25 people on stage.
Yeah, exactly. So I was at the NAMM show, which is the National Association of Music Merchandisers or something. And it's a giant thing that happens at the LA Convention Center every year.
Right.
P-Funk was playing at one of the big stages. And I went up with my violin to the stage and I tried my little thing. And George took the microphone and he put it on the violin. And they were so loud, you couldn't hear anything I was doing. So that was it as far as he was concerned. But I was like, I've waited too long to do this. I fucking have to play with them. I just knew it in my bones. So I went and found an amplifier in the convention center. I brought it into the room I climbed up on stage under their legs, because I'm 5 feet tall, climbed up under their legs, found a plug on stage, plugged in the amplifier, and plugged myself in, and then popped up next to George Clinton. And he looked at me like, do I need security to get this strange goth creature off of my fucking stage? And he looked at me like, is she crazy or what's going to happen? And he sang me a little riff and I played it back to him. And then we had this conversation and it turned into this, you know, this musical love affair. And after the show, he took me aside and we went back to, you know, the entourage went back to his hotel. He listened to my whole record and the best compliment he gave me was I was funky.
If you're listening on audio, you were holding your nose and waving your arm. That's how funky it was.
And if you're listening on audio, I started this interview by putting on a lot of eye makeup. Actually, not enough, though. Apparently, I need more. You need to come over and just, you know, put it on.
we'll put makeup on each other. We'll figure it out.
Okay. So anyway, so we and then they invited me to play Woodstock with them. So that's how
Woodstock 99 or
yep, Woodstock 99, and I got to jam.
I was there.
I was in pink on the violin.
I missed George Clinton and P-Funk altogether. But now you're a P-Funk all-star.
Well, I used to be. I was an honorary member. I enjoyed all I could enjoy. Back in, I think 2006 was my last show. And it just was, it was time to move on. George is like a, he's one of my mentors, and what can I say? He's family.
Now can I ask, I love P-Funk, but I mean, like I said, there's so many musicians I don't know. Did the original P-Funk have a violin player or no?
No. There was
one in the 70s and 80s.
Sly, they never had a violin player. Sly and the Family Stone did. Sly was actually married to a violinist.
Right.
So she played with him.
Okay.
But no, I was the first and only violinist, I'm told, for P-Funk.
Right. And if you go to the website, your website, there's a footage of you playing with, I mean, it doesn't get bigger than Rolling Stones, Page and Plant, George Clinton, Roger Waters of Pink Floyd, you playing comfortable, you playing Comfortably Numb with Roger Waters. He starts it off. I'm like, well, who's going to sing David Gilmour's part and who's going to do the guitar solo? Other than my new friend, Lily Hayden. How is that? And how do you make a violin sound like a guitar?
You know, it's just the heart. It's the approach. You know, there are little technical. I mean, there are technical things, but I feel like, you know, when you listen to David Gilmour play his solos, it doesn't have to be guitar. You know, that man's heart is crying and screaming, and whatever if he played anything, it would sound like that. You'd feel the same thing, I think. So, you know, there are things I have to do to compensate for the fact that my violin is tuned in fifths and the guitar is tuned in fourths. So there are certain slides and like idiomatic sounds that, you know, I've had to learn to kind of emulate certain things. But I feel it. I feel it in my bones. I salivate in the same, you know, like when I hear Roger Waters and Jimmy Page and Eddie Hazel, you know, the rock gods.
It's almost a spiritual thing for you.
Oh, it's definitely. You know, I was always a big crier. I cry easily. And I'm an only child and my parents are dead and I have no siblings and I had no friends. Oh, my cat was my only friend, you know, like, so there was a lot of emotion, to be had in this little body. And who gives a shit if you don't make it entertaining? Right. My mom used to say, you know, it's unfair to talk about your life if you don't make it entertaining. So I basically, violin was the way that I was able to express my emotion and people could relate to it. So music has been that outlet for me. And I think, you know, the arts has always been the outlet for the, you know, it's therapy. And in fact, you know, you can look at some of the most dastardly people in history and see that they were failed artists. Hitler was a failed artist.
Right. You know? Right.
Who knows what I would have been without, my father was a sociopath. So I could have, you know, I think that truthfully, I could have, you know, I could, if it weren't for violin, who knows what I'd be doing now.
Right. And, that's a great segue. And by the way, just one random question here. I noticed that you played on the Hootie and the Blowfish Crack Rearview record, which is one of the, I'm not a big Hootie and the Blowfish fan, but that record is one of the top 20 selling records of all time.
Is it really?
Being that there's no record stores anymore, it's always going to be.
Wow.
Do you get a bonus when it sells that big?
I should look into that. I don't know. They gave me, I remember when they went platinum and they said they had a present for me, and it was like, it was a Hootie and the Blowfish hat. It's like, I expected like a solid gold hat or something. I'm going to look into that. That's a good question.
I think there might be some faulty accounting somewhere, but you went solo with your album Lily, and actually, Stranger became kind of a semi-hit.
I've had my last two solo records actually had gotten the most radio play, I think.
Really? Okay.
The song More Love is actually getting a fair amount of radio play. Which is nice. All I care about is, my mom used to say, the only thing that's fair is between you and the creation. And so I give my heart to in as fully as possible. And then the rest of it, you know, you just do what you can do and try to navigate the game, basically.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard in a while. I have Apple Music, and Stranger is on a 90s dance compilation along with Come and Ride the Train and Informer and Rump Shaker, I think.
Wow, that's so
like
cool.
It's the last song. It's really weird.
Wow.
And that just came out like last year. Yeah.
Very nice.
So, I think probably the song that I see most often that people are really, online raving about is the one that you did on Californication, Set of Sunset.
I think that to me that, you know, that's nice. What it tells me is that I just need to do more TV. when there's exposure, you know, it's like, just the more we spread the word, it's just, it's harder to, I don't know. I don't like to complain. I just need to spread the word. So.
All right. Because you were friends with Pamela Adlon and she got you on Californication. Yeah. And apparently, people have been searching the internet for the song that you did and have been for years.
That's cool. I'd like to, David Duchovny actually asked me to play with his band. I almost was on his record. He had a blues band. I don't know if he's still doing that.
Oh, okay. Well, we're almost over at overtime. I've just got a couple questions. I really want to get into the new record because I really love it.
Thanks.
But I mean, you cheated death a couple times to get to where you are now.
That's exciting.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Ooh, I don't know if it's that's exciting, but
cheating death is always exciting.
Yeah.
You had a pesticide problem in your house.
Yeah, I got brain damage from pesticides in my house. Yeah, it's actually a pesticide that's called Chlordane, and it's in 30 to 60 million homes in America, and it's still a lot in America. It's still shipped overseas. The parent company was Chevron, so there were all class action lawsuits were squashed, it was in my house. I had to get rid of everything I owned. I was happily able to clean the house, thank God, but I got brain damage and I got my brains back from playing classical music again.
That's beautiful. That's remarkable.
I did a TED talk about it actually. It's called How Music Saved My Brain. There I found out that music actually activates the brain in ways that nothing else does. It actually causes neurogenesis, where scientists had previously thought that once your brain cells had, died, you were basically fucked. But now there are things we can do, music being one of the most important ones, that actually cause new synaptic firings and new pathways in the brain to be formed. So I learned a lot about that, and thank God I'm cool. I can tell I don't multitask as well. I can't listen to music or have two conversations. I'll tell you. Okay. Okay, it's probably no secret that I'll leave this the artist's name out of it. But I ended up playing with so after I got brain damage, I was recovering from brain damage. I was asked to go play with this artist who was smoking crack, and previous to my brain damage, I was on tour with a band that was smoking crack, and I basically just was able to like put an air purifier in my bunk. And not have to, you know, and I was okay with it. But after my brain damage, I was in this room with somebody who was smoking crack, and I got so fucked up from it. The next time I went down there, I wore a gas mask and said, "I'm gonna play like this from now on." And what I realized was that after my brain damage, I couldn't handle secondhand crack smoke the way I used to be able to. So I had to make a couple of adjustments. Basically music saved my brain. And then I got COVID in July and had a little brush with not being able to breathe. And thank God I was able to, you know, my immune system kicked in. But I did get a taste of what's actually happening here. And this is not an ordinary flu.
Right. Nicole just got her shot. Hopefully you'll get yours soon, and I'll get mine soon.
Do you still need if you had the virus? Don't you have the antibodies now?
You know, they're not. There's so much that they don't know about COVID that they still are encouraging people, and they're especially because my antibodies may not cover the variants, but the Pfizer one does, or so they think.
It was painless. It's really quick. Like I was shocked. It's literally like just poke and go. So it was really quick.
I want it.
What I found interesting though, when you were recovering from the pesticide, is that you could you could play violin, but you couldn't sing for a time. Is that right?
It's not that I couldn't sing. I just couldn't think. I couldn't write lyrics. I stopped being able to put sentences together, honestly. There was about a year there where I was so fucked up that I was in traffic and I saw a red light and thought it meant go, and I rear-ended somebody because I was fucked up. They call it toxic inebriation. And you had
to get everything out of your house, everything.
Yeah, I had to get everything out of the house. I had to hire hazmat people to clean the house, and did a what they call crawl space encapsulation. So basically, it was like starting from the ground up. I rebuilt the house in order to save it. But the biggest thing was, you know, there was about a year where I was scared. I didn't know what I was gonna. I didn't know if I'd ever be the same.
Wow. And that's a metaphor for your musical career.
Yeah.
And you're back because not only were you you've been scoring things, but you have another group, Opium Moon, that won a Grammy a couple of years ago. So you're a Grammy Award winner.
I am. In fact, you can see it in the background, that little thing right there.
That's it. I see it. And so is your husband. So yes, good for you.
Absolutely.
Good for both of you.
That was nice because it would have been tough if one of us had won and the other hadn't, even though we would, of course, have been supportive. But it was lovely that we were able to. I was headlining a festival a couple of years, about 5 years ago, 5 years ago. And the sound went out, and it was a time when I was working heavily with production. So I had like loops and, you know, beats and cool shit. It was like, you know, the way people do. And the production all went out, and the feedback, it was just everything. It was a disaster. And I thought, fuck this. I only want to just do what I can do in a room without electricity. I'm going to go back to, you know, I'm going to do Armageddon music from now on. And I did a record with a wonderful composer, pianist, named William Goldstein, and where we basically improvised the record, and it was, and I had to just fly on the feet of my the string of what's the expression, the seat of my pants.
So your pants.
Yeah.
Kind of a, anyway.
The string of your bow. Yes, I'm not sure.
The head, by the whisker of my cat. And I realized this can be done, and this is so thrilling, and the thrill of being of jumping out of this, you know, this airplane of sorts, and not knowing where I'm going to land, but needing to be so in the pocket with my viol, you know, in the flow of inspiration, and basically having my technical shit together so that I could land anywhere and make sure that it was in tune. You know, that kind of thrill, being on the flow and taking risks like that, there's just no greater thrill in the world. And I realized that to be able to do that was something that was really important for me. And so then I fell in love with this Persian hammer dulcimer player, Santur, named Hamid Saidi. Brilliant player, and I just, when I heard him play, it was like, you and I are making a record. And I heard, and I like stalked him, and he and I got together, and then we pulled in my husband and the percussion player, and when we got together in this room, it was just literally the angels just made every single step of it happen. It was like the second second the idea happened, it came to me, it was every single melody, every step of the way, like one thing after another. It was like I was possessed by needing to make this happen. And we got into a room, and the first thing we played is on our first Grammy winning record. It came together. It was just magic. And so we're putting out new music now.
Which is terrific. I've listened to it.
Well, we're coming out with a double album in the summer, and we put out a single a couple weeks ago and an EP before that, and then we're coming out with a new single in a month, and we're just sort of leading up to this double album, which is going to be all of our up-tempo, danceable, cool, like party songs, and then also all of our chill-out making love songs. And so it'll be Opium Moon Day and Night. We were going to call it Opium Moon Dancing and Fucking. But that was a little on the nose. So we just.
Was that your idea? Was it his idea?
This has been something that I wanted to do for a while. But, you know, we don't really. The thing about Opium Moon also is that we have. It's such magic, and it's been given so. So like the connection between idea and manifestation has been, we've been given the gift of magic together in such a way that it feels wrong to even claim credit for it. And, you know, it doesn't actually, like what we do together, it's so much more than any one individual idea or melody. You know, if somebody writes a melody and we all, you know, make music around that melody, that the song itself is so much more, it's about the magic and the spontaneity and the history of these four musicians, that, you know, taking credit seems wrong. It's really channeled by all of us.
Nicole, you were going to say?
Oh no, I just think that it's incredible that not only did you two find each other, but you're able to create this art together that's really beautiful and definitely magical.
It really is. It's such a blessing.
Is it destiny that you would end up with a musician? Is there something when you guys play that there's a connection that nobody sees?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, he's the kind of person that I would, if I were married to somebody else, I would cheat on that person to be with him. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, I tell him all the time that I feel like, you know, I would cheat on somebody. I would kill for, you know, it's like, he's just, it's, there's, you know, he, like me, is married to music above and beyond anything else. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. you know, it's bigger than an idea. It's bigger than logic. It's bigger than any of that. So to be able to meet in that unconditionally passionate realm is, it's, what can I say? It's incomparable. You really, like, there's nobody, you know, I don't think any relationship would last that wasn't this, because I am too much of an inconsiderate bitch to, you know, I'm being glib. You know, obviously I
was going to say, just as you had us aroused and jealous.
Yeah. No, it's just, what I mean is that connection, magic, maybe it's because, you know, my mom and dad, that's the thread that kept them together for 18 years was this passion. Right. And magic, you know, the magic of art, of music, of the muse, of the flow, is more important.
Of nonconformity too.
It's nonconformity, but really just being a slave to the flow. That feeling is, you know, I live for that. That's what I think, honestly, I think that's what we're all going for. People, everybody, you know, whether, you know, somebody is a drug addict, they're looking for the flow, that feeling of connection, you know, religious extremists. I feel like that's the motivator. It's that spark of magic. It's the thing that makes you wanna, you know, that gives you joy, that gives you, so I've devoted my life to that. And so my partnership with my beloved is based on that. And that's good, because if it weren't based on that, it would have, I'm sure I'd be alone.
Which brings us full circle to tomorrow on Apple Music and everywhere else in record stores, your album More Love comes out. Mm-hmm. Your first solo album, rock album, for lack of a better word, in 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It was time. And,
you think so?
Well, I had been sitting on, you know, like after, so I got, I put out the previous solo album in 2014, and then I ended up getting a bunch of scoring work, you know, film scoring work, which took me away from songwriting. And then Trump got in, and when Trump got in, I went into shock. My system was like, all right, well, I guess the world is upside down. I don't know how to relate to this anymore. You know, words don't matter. There's no truth. There's no, you know, if people aren't viscerally feeling how, you know, if this is really the state of the world, then I just need to sit back and wait and see what's going to happen. I lost my desire to sing protest songs, even, because it was like, who gives a shit? Nobody. We're still going to get maced. We're still going to get pepper sprayed in the park. You know, it doesn't like, you know, nobody's listening. That's why, you know, I was a big Bernie Sanders supporter, but I supported Biden because I thought, well, what foe do you want to be fighting against? What right. adversary do you want? Is it somebody who's going to bring out the tanks and mow you down, or somebody who might be a neoliberal who might still be a corporate shill a little bit, but will be swayed by protest, and is still, you know, seemingly a decent human being. And I, you know, and the truth is, I lost my desire to do anything but play my violin and just kind of make pure music. Basically, Opium Moon was the embodiment of the peace and the inclusion and the multiculturalism that I wanted to see in the world, because we're from, you know, the band is from Iran, Israel, United States, and Canada, and I wrote Sayonara, which is a prayer for peace. You know, enough with the drama, no more war. I don't care what you say you're fighting for, really,
I'll go along with that,
and a declaration that I I don't want to be a part of the systems of oppression. And on my last record, I wrote a song called Tyrant, which recognized that, you know, how will I, what hope is there for peace in the world if I don't disarm the tyrant inside me? You know, I go protest greed and hate, but I'll come home with my own nuclear weapons race. You know, we can, anyway, so I realized that, and especially when I was doing, when I was studying the brain because of my own brain damage, I discovered that when fear is activated, the amygdala, the lizard brain, is activated. And when that happens, it literally hijacks the energy from the rest of the brain. So that people who are motivated by fear, you can't expect them to feel empathy, because that part, the part of the brain that feels empathy, is robbed of its juice. The battery's gone.
Right.
So fighting people and trying to appeal to people's logic when fear is activated is pointless. It's fruitless. All you're going to get is it's going to reinforce the fear and the confrontation, that system of domination that is causing the bad behavior, or the behavior that we're talking about in the first place. So I realized that only more love will actually will shape the future in ways that I want to be a part of. And that's why the album is called More Love. There's no problem for which more love and understanding is not the answer.
I agree with that.
And more music. And there's two parts to Sayonara.
Yeah.
There's Sayonara Part 1, there's Sayonara Part 2. I found, I was listening to it, and they're two very, very different songs. Sayonara Part 2 at the end, really, I was getting My Bloody Valentine vibes. I really, really, I don't know if that was an influence, but it was really, musically, it was very, very interesting.
Thank you.
Your Overture, which is on the album, speaking of scoring, reminded me of Hal Hartley scores.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Which is very high compliment.
I'm writing that down right now. Hal Hartley, I said thank you, because I trust that was a compliment, but I don't actually.
We had Hal Hartley on our show, by the way. Next week we're having our 8th anniversary, and I had Hal Hartley call in, and we had clowns in the studio. But that's the kind of show I do. But the two songs that really got me, and I'm saying the whole album's great.
Thank you.
But you know, within an album, there are some songs that really stand out, and to me, Is This Love, Is This Life?
Thank you.
Really was. Just I was kind of cruising along, and then that really hit me, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. Just
thank
musically.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
and
that.
And The Devil You Know Which Follows is just, to me, that's my favorite song on the record.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And they're all good.
They're both included in a film that I scored that's on Netflix now. Called Strip Down, Rise Up. It's a documentary, feature documentary by Oscar nominee Michelle Ohayon. And it's about women who are women empowerment, basically women who are healing trauma through movement, and specifically pole dancing. So it's sort of half.
Those are my two favorite songs on the record.
Yeah. So you should watch the movie. It's good. It's really good.
I got to get Netflix. You're all over Netflix.
I was a little skeptical when I didn't know the world very well, and I didn't, you know, and there's a little bit of a group therapy vibe the film follows a group of women who are enrolled in this class called S Factor.
Right.
Basically, it's a pole dancing class, but it's part movement, it's part therapy, it's part, you know, it's part gestalt therapy. I wasn't sure how, for my new age background, and mysticism and all that, I tend to get quite cynical around just sort of new age concepts. And, you know, like I feel like if you haven't embraced the shadow in equal parts to the light, then, you know, then to me, it doesn't resonate. So, but I was truly.
Well, I have a question, because I work with crystals and candles and the light side of the force, so to speak. But if the answer is more love, shouldn't that mean that you need more love? Like, people that you're trying to reach, a lot of them, the people that are fear driven, don't do shadow work. That's part of the whole problem.
Sure. And what I mean by that is, basically, I was talking specifically about Strip Down, Rise Up, where I was just really moved by how authentic the transformations were by these women. But to speak to what you're saying, absolutely. I think more love and understanding, you know, and I don't just mean like, you know, love the murderer. But I think when we humanize each other and we understand where we come from and we listen to each other, if we feel heard, when I think that listening is probably the active part of loving. It's probably listening to each other is probably the most loving thing we can do. Actually, it's, you know, because we all just need to feel heard. I think when we feel heard, we're much more likely to listen to the other person. And then we actually give each other the space to exist. That to me is what I mean by more love.
Okay.
But and
people.
I know nothing. I don't know shit. but my experience is that when I've met people around, you know, the people who are
love and light.
Like, you know, love and light. Look, I grew up in communes and with cult leaders. So when people say love and light, and then they're just trying to fuck you in the back room, it makes you a little bit cynical about people who say love and light. You know what I mean? And like, and then you see them kind of like, you know, jawing in the back. You know, some of the most egregious crimes have been perpetrated by people who, in the name of Jesus or in the name of love and light. So, which is why I mean, why I say, it that without embracing, without, you know, when we don't look deeper, it just lighting a candle without listening to somebody's pain, I think it's just a band-aid on something much deeper. I think we have to.
Going through a lot, and I have been through a lot. I asked, how is this fair? How is this right? And the universe answered, I move the people. So you always got to look for, it's like that thing that Mr. Rogers said, that when you see something bad happening, you got to look for the people that are doing the nice thing in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. So some love and light people are a little crazy, but some of us volunteer our time in helping people. And without that overall philosophy that we could be better, that there is a higher truth, there's something we can ascend to, people wouldn't try very hard.
Oh, absolutely. And forgive me
I'm not offended or anything. I was simply expressing my journey.
Totally. No, I love this. I absolutely love this. And there's clearly I'm just trying to evolve and open my mind, but what I have, you know, having come up
with, a lot too, like just what we've been discussing, you've seen a lot of darkness,
a lot of weird shit. And also, and the thing that to me is the most offensive is when, and I'll just tell you, so the commandment, thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain, to me, that doesn't mean don't say goddamn. It means don't use the Lord's name to justify your own vanity, your own vain agenda, to say that my way is the only way. Because there are I've been around a lot of ugliness that's been perpetrated in the name of the one true God, you know, the one true way. And so when I think, I guess what I mean is, love and light without the embracing of, without listening to, without accepting that there is pain. And
that acceptance, that's key. The acceptance is the thing that makes it love and light. Exactly. Like, if you're not accepting people, you're not following the great truths, which are treat each other how you want to be treated. You know, at the end of the day, all the religions come down to the golden rule.
Absolutely. 100%.
Well, we love and accept Lily Hayden. I have And I really love the fact that you've gone an extra half hour with us. You didn't have to, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're one.
I have one last question. Nicole, go ahead.
Oh, I already said what I was saying.
Thank you. And thank you.
Zoom sucks. I hate Zoom. I say it every week. I hate the delays on Zoom.
Yeah.
But my question was, in addition to what's the movie we were just saying, the
Strip Down Rise Up movie? Oh, Strip Down Rise Up.
Strip Down Rise Up. And in addition to that, you have you've scored a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah. It's a brilliant follow-up to the hit documentary RBG that came out a couple of years ago. And it's deep and soulful and emotionally driven and directed by Oscar winner Frieda Lee Mock, who also did the wonderful documentary Anita about Anita Hill, which I scored about 6 years ago, 5 years ago. It's on Amazon Prime and Stars Network and wherever you watch movies. It's beautiful. So that's all these three things came out. Ginny and Georgia, Ruth, and Strip Down Rise Up all came out in 1 month. So I decided that it was time to release my record at the same time, just so I could I could merge my identity as a recording artist and film composer, because it's really the sound of the films that I'd like to be scoring, and some of the music that is in the films, and it just felt like it was time to come out with this.
But what a daunting responsibility to compose a piece of music that encompasses Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah, it's really. It is, and also I always think about it sort of like I'm collaborating with another songwriter. You know, her voice is the lead singer. She's the music already. So I'm just accompanying in a way. And also because RBG was such a hit, and the score for that was great, I knew that there was sort of a guideline around what, that I knew I didn't want to do that because that had already been done. And the director gave me this sort of the task of being a little bit more emotionally driven than and personal and intimate than the other film. So, which is what the nature of this film is. So yeah, it was daunting, but when it comes down to film music, I'm just letting it pour through me, and then fortunately the muse speak to me and help me come out with something.
Ruth Ginsburg's quite a muse. Anyway, Nicole, how much fun was this?
This is great. I love Lily. I think she's amazing. We've really enjoyed ourselves. And it's rare I get to talk about magic on the show, so it's a big part of who I am.
I can tell. Thank you.
And so, Lily, everybody that's listening and watching us, including ourselves, has fallen in love with you. Don't tell your husband, but tell me all you have going on and do all your promotion.
Okay, so best thing to do is just go to my website.
More Love comes out on Friday.
More Love comes out tomorrow, and I love it. And put it on your Spotify playlists, and go to my website and at lilyhayden.com, and everything's there. The TV show, the movies, the new video. I'm doing a video for Is This Love, Is This Life that I'm really excited about. The Opium Moon records that are coming out, and some of the political activism that I do. It's all on lilyhayden.com or Instagram. I've been posting quite a bit lately. But do, if you would, Spotify, I guess, is the new playground. So please follow me there and you'll get everything.
Right. And Nicole, tell everybody how to get a hold of you.
Hi. So you can follow me at Nicole Six Books. And right now I'm taking on new clients for social media management, which I don't do full social media. I only do Instagram. But if you want to be an Instagram celebrity and you want real people, not just like fake bots following you, just hit me up and send me a direct message.
And I'm Goth Comedian on all social media. This was amazing. Lily, thank you so much for being on the show. And everybody, add more love to your Spotify playlist.
Thank you so much for having me. What a blast talking to you both. And really appreciate the kindness and support and the friendship. And I look forward to staying in touch. And Nicole, I'm going to call you about social media stuff too.
That sounds great. I'd love to help. I like what you do. It would be an honor to help.
Thank you. All right. Wonderful.
Everybody have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.
Bye.